Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of South Dakota, the Honorable David Silverson presiding, is now open for the transaction of any business that may legally come before it.
Good morning. The first case for oral argument this morning is Jeannie Weekly Appellant versus Jerry Prostralo and Robert J. Wagner Appellees. For the appellant, we have Mr. Gregory Stoltenberg and Mr. Todd Boyd, attorneys from Clear Lake. I understand that Mr. Stoltenberg, you'll be presenting the argument this morning.
Yes, I am.
Okay. And for the appellee, Wagner, we have Mr. James Power, attorney from Sioux Falls, and Mr. Richard Gregerson, also from Sioux Falls. And I understand, Mr. Power, you'll be speaking for 10 minutes, but going second.
That's correct.
All right. And then we have also Mr. James Roby and Mr. George Hawkins, attorneys from Watertown, who represent Mr. Prostralo. I understand, Mr. Roby, that you will be going first and also speaking for 10 minutes.
Yes.
Okay, now that we have the lineups all set, I should also note for the record that Justice Zinner has disqualified himself, and the court has appointed the Honorable Stephen Jensen, a circuit judge from the First Judicial Circuit, to sit in Justice Zinner's place. With that, Mr. Stoltenberg, you may proceed, and you have 20 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Chief Justice. May it please the court, counsel, the facts in this case are undisputed. It's the application of those facts to the law is where the circuit court erred in this case. There are two significant issues that were in controversy concerning this. Jeannie Weekly sued the personal representatives in their individual capacity to collect funds which she is entitled to from the estate, and the reason she is entitled to collect those funds is due to the negligence and breach of fiduciary duties by both Robert Wagner, the defendant, and Jerry Prostralo, the defendant. This case, Jerry Prostralo was the personal representative of this estate for 5 years and 2 months. He resigned. Bob Wagner became the personal representative. He is now the current personal representative of the estate and continues in that capacity. The breaches of their fiduciary duty deal with their failure to collect, manage, and preserve the assets of this estate and to timely distribute the assets to the heir that is entitled to those assets.
Did your client object to the release of Mr. Prostralo?
Yes.
They did object. Okay.
Yep. We filed a formal objection to that.
On what grounds?
On those exact grounds that he would be possibly released from liability.
All right.
And in that regard, Chief Justice, the resignation of a personal representative does not cut the tail off of that personal representative from personal liability. There are statutes that apply that deal specifically with that issue. He still has a duty to turn the assets over to the successor personal representative. Mr. Prostralo still had a duty to account for the assets. He still had a duty to maintain those assets. He just doesn't have the power to sign anything on behalf of the personal representative in that capacity. But the statute that I'm referring to is SDCL 29A3-608, and that's where the termination does not discharge a personal representative from liability from transactions or omissions occurring before termination or relieve the personal representative of the duty to preserve assets subject to the control to and to account thereof and deliver the assets. So even though Mr. Prostralo resigned, court order authorized his resignation, it still does not cut him off from further duties thereafter.
But it cuts him off from future liability.
Yes. Yep, for future acts. Correct.
But if he made a full accounting to Wagner at the point that he left, he'd have no further duty to preserve those assets, would he?
That's correct, Justice Sabers.
Yes.
Yep. And what you have here is What Jeannie Weekly showed to the circuit court was that this estate was mismanaged. Okay? They failed to collect, first of all, they failed to collect the federal estate taxes from the individual that owed them. Okay? And Randy Brownlee, who's another heir under the estate, received in excess of $230,000 of property.
To this, is there a dispute on that amount?
No.
Okay.
No. That amount is set pursuant to the federal estate tax return, the South Dakota inheritance tax return. It shows it right on there. If you look at the federal estate tax return, it actually has it down to the penny as to the amount allocated to Randy Brownlee. To this date, they still have not got a trial date set for collection of those taxes. Mr. Brownlee, Walter Brownlee Sr., died in 1997.
Going back to the amount that Randy Brownlee got, that $200,000+, did that included the value of the construction equipment?
Yes, it did.
Okay, which he didn't get.
And that's a good point, because, yes, he did. Okay, one, he was in possession of it at the date of the decedent's death.
Right, but a judge ordered, or the Supreme Court ordered that it was not a gift, and therefore it belongs to the estate.
Right. And what's interesting about that point, Justice Sabers, is because that bill of sale was, whether you call it a gift or not a gift, wasn't really an issue on the taxes owed, because the taxes were owed on that property because it was a gift in contemplation of death under the Internal Revenue Code rules. So it would have been included in the estate, allocated to Randy Brownlee, regardless of whether the gift was validated or not. If you're understanding where I'm going with that.
No, I don't.
Okay.
You're saying that even though they take the property away from him, he has to pay the tax on something he doesn't get?
The estate was handling as though the gift was valid. The PRs were saying that gift was valid. Randy Brownlee, that's your equipment. You're in possession of it. We're relying on the bill of sale. Later on, Jeannie Weekly petitioned the lower court and said that was an invalid gift, and that was affirmed on appeal, and the property came back into the estate. Okay, and ultimately went to Randy Brownlee through the residual of the estate. But whether he gets the property through the residue of the estate or whether that gift was not valid or was valid and he received the property pursuant to that bill of sale, Randy Brownlee is the one that owed the taxes on that. That's because of the Internal Revenue Code rules that any gifts given in contemplation of death, and I believe under federal law it's 9 months, under state law it was 1 year look-back period. If the gift was made within that time frame, 9 months from the date of death, before the date of death, that property gets drawn back in for federal estate tax purposes and taxes due on it. So the amount that $170,000+ of construction equipment that Randy Brownlee was in possession in, he owes the tax on that, whether that gift was validated or not.
I don't want to waylay you there, but I have trouble with that, since it was not a gift. It was not a gift in contemplation of death. It was determined, which was not appealed by, it was determined not to be a gift. So, you know, I'm not...
It was determined, and maybe it's easier if you focus on what the personal representative was doing, because that's what we're dealing with on this issue.
Let's just skip to the rest of your argument.
Right, okay. And I'll tie that in. Because the personal representative, Jerry Prostrello at that time, there were taxes owed to the federal government for the estate. Jeannie Weekly, they collected all of her assets that she was devised, $580,000 worth of CDs. They collected $25,000 of her own personal funds, and then they used that money to pay 100% of the federal estate taxes, even though Jerry Prostrello said that it was everyone should pay their fair share of the taxes. That was the position that the estate was taking, that everyone pays their percentage of those taxes. And what I think is important for the court to understand is Jerry Prestrello was appointed as the personal representative in September of 1998. Jeannie Weekly does not bring a petition to assert anything on the alleged or the gift to Randy Brownlee on the construction equipment, does not assert anything concerning the proper allocation of the federal estate tax and South Dakota Inheritance Tax till the year 2000. Okay? Jerry Prestrello files a brief with the circuit court back in January 2001 and says, my position is that everyone pays their fair share of taxes based on the percentage of property that they received. Randy Brownlee received, pursuant to the federal estate tax return, $232,000 worth of property. During the time of his appointment till Jeannie Weekly filed a petition, he did zero to collect any taxes.
That was the estate's position at the time, but what was your client's position at that time? She didn't agree with that, did she? Nor did Randy Brownlee?
No.
So there was a dispute.
Right.
I mean, the estate, personal representative, your client, and Mr. Brownlee, they all took three different positions, right?
Yes. Yes, Judge Jensen, they did.
Now, I'm confused on the facts. You said that Randy got the machinery. I thought it was sold at auction.
In 2006.
Okay.
1997 to 2006. It? No, the estate finally went in after Brownlee 2 was decided. And said, well, Brownlee 1 determined that machinery was part of the estate.
Right.
A final conclusion. Even though the circuit court had ruled back in June of 2001 that it was part of the estate, they actually did not take possession of that equipment until 2006, nearly a five-year period. Even though they had decisions and rulings and nobody was doing anything. That was really the problem. They were not doing anything to collect and manage and preserve these assets. That's their duty. That is their absolute duty under the state code. It's a fiduciary duty, the highest standard that you can have under the law. And, you know, here I'll just give you an example. Is a personal representative is obligated to use, it's a reasonable person standard, to use reasonable care in the management of the estate as if they were their own assets. And I put to you, if a circuit court rules in June of 2001 that you now own $171,000 of construction equipment, and that's your property, but you never go out and look at it, you never photograph it, you don't insure it, you don't do anything, you just leave it sit, and you know it's being used on a daily basis. That's what the PR did. That's negligence. That's negligence in allowing that equipment to continue to be used and depreciated during the tenure that
well, the trial court agrees with that, didn't it? I mean, the trial court did agree that that was negligence, didn't
it? On Jerry Prestrello, he said it's negligence, but not, it did not relate to how Jeannie Weekly did not relate to her damages. Okay? Because there's a duty breach causing damages. I mean, just basic tort law. And Weekly has damages. And we have the duty. We have a breach. This element right here, whether this breach caused these damages, is really where the circuit court ruled on and said there was no connection between those two. That's error. Circuit Court erred in that regard. Okay. And I'm getting down on time.
I thought he took the position that you failed to prove damage, that you didn't accept the burden of proving damages and then that you didn't prove the damages.
As to Defendant Wagner, that was the analysis. As to defendant Prostrello, it was that third element.
What is that third element?
The link between the duty, breach, the cause, the proximate cause, and then damages. That was Prostrello, no proximate cause. As to Wagner, okay, no damages.
Go back to the estate tax thing. You're trying to collect estate tax from the personal representative that you say the estate, that he should have collected from Mr. Brownlee. And I guess my question is, are we in danger of having an inconsistent result if we rule in your client's favor and the other court that has yet to set a trial date, you said, mm-hmm, may come to a different conclusion?
Right. And that's exactly the point, Justice Konenkamp, is the circuit court may come to a totally different conclusion because there may be statute of limitations issues. There may be latches issues. There's lots of defenses that Randy Brownlee may have to be able to use against the personal representative, but those are defenses due to the delays.
But what if those defenses are denied, but the court just simply comes to an inconsistent result?
But you're not awarding Jeannie Weekly the amount of the federal estate taxes, or you're not awarding her the amount of the equipment. What is being awarded to her is the amount of her devise. Okay? We show that they would have, had they done their duty, they would have had this pot of gold. Out of that pot of gold, they can pay Jeannie Weekly.
But if the court decides, the other court decides that there was no estate tax due from Mr. Brownlee, for some reason, how can we hold the personal representative liable for having not collected it?
And that argument becomes very circular, because then the incentive is for the personal representative to never have that decided. Because then we can never, what came first, the chicken or the egg, is essentially that argument is, okay, personal representative says, I'm not going to do anything, because as soon as we determine how much the tax is owed, then we'll turn that over to Jeannie Weekly, okay? But what incentive is there for them to go forward unless they're surcharged, okay? It's been 97, 2009 now. Well, you can do the math on the number of years and number of months. This was owed within 9 months of date of death, and it has been determined in Brownlee 1 that the amount that the beneficiaries, it's apportioned between them, and there's no dispute as to the amount owed by Randy Brownlee. Not the amount owed, the amount of property he received. He received $171,000 of construction equipment. He received $52,000 of real estate. He received an IRA of $8,157 and $200 worth of guns. That's what he received. That's in the record. Those are concrete numbers. So, Justice Konenkamp, I understand your concern of inconsistent opinions, but isn't 12 years enough? And the reason we are here and that problem is presented is because they didn't do their job. They didn't determine how much these taxes were when they should have. That's not Jeannie Weekly's fault. That's the personal representative's duty. Their breach of that duty is their negligence. And that's what, bottom line, it gets down to.
Explain your damage theory to me. What, okay, you have a breach, courts found proximate cause.
Yep.
As to Wagner. What grounds did he err on the damage? What's your theory as to how he erred on the damage?
On how the circuit court erred?
Yeah.
Okay. If you look at the damages, Jeannie Weekly's entitled $82,535. That's the amount of devise that she's owed. If you look at the other damages she has, which is $80-some thousand, it's interest due to delay, okay, attorney fees that were awarded, the circuit court affirmed at this level, what the PR didn't do. Okay? It was in Brownlee, too, where that was decided, but a little over $18,000 of attorney fees were awarded to Jeannie Wheatley. Okay? As a result of the failure of the personal representative to properly prosecute an action to collect that $171,000. Wheatley benefited the estate, okay, because the personal representative didn't do their job. They breached their duty. That's a direct result of their fiduciary duty breach. The interest on her devise that she's owed is a direct result of this court determining in Brownlee 2 that there was no legal justification for the then 3-year delay in distributing for not collecting this construction equipment. That is it ended up being about a 5-year delay before they actually went out and collected that equipment and sold it, and by then it was worth $26,000. Those portions of the damages, Judge Jensen, are directly related to breaches of duties. And that's where the circuit court erred. I mean, when you look at that, and it is Plaintiff's Exhibit 8. Okay, it is the amended judgment entered by the circuit court after Brownlee 2. The last page on that exhibit has the exact precise calculations as to dates that interest started to accrue and how much Jeannie Wheatley's devise is. It's to the penny, and I see I'm out of time.
Time has expired. Thank you, Mr. Stoltenberg.
Thanks.
Mr. Roby, you have 10 minutes, sir.
May it please the court, good morning. In my time here this morning, I will first address the comments made by Mr. Stoltenberg on some of the specific facts in this case. And then I would like to turn my attention to the standard of review before this court, because that's real critical to the analysis of where Jerry Prostrello stands. And last, I will conclude by asking this court to affirm the trial court's decision in finding that Jerry Prostrello was not negligent, had not breached any duty, and therefore no cause of action or no damages would lie against Jerry Prostrello. Let me go to that point first, though, because there was some discussion just a few minutes ago about whether the trial court found that Jerry Prostrello was negligent, and I believe Mr. Stoltenberg said that, yes, he was found negligent, but no proximate cause. That is not correct. The trial court's decision found that Jerry Prostrello did not breach any duty. Was not found negligent. The court noted that in regard to the failure to take possession of equipment or inventory after the petition was filed in December of 2000, it is this court's opinion that Ms. Wheatley has failed to prove that Prostrello breached his fiduciary duty and was the cause of her damages during his tenure as personal representative.
Now, is this decision part of Prostrello 1, 2, or the current appeal?
That is the trial court's decision in this case.
All right. So we've not reviewed that issue before.
That's correct.
All right.
That's correct. Let me go back to some of the facts that Mr. Stoltenberg talked about and highlight a couple of the points. Early in his comments, he stated that in discharging the personal representative, the personal representative still has some duties. We don't dispute that. He has a duty to turn over assets, to account, and to maintain assets that were in his possession. I think there was an implication here in the argument that those things did not happen. There is no issue in this case that Mr. Prostrello did not do any of those things. In fact, we know from the record that Mr. Prostrello was permitted to be discharged because of health reasons. The same attorney who was handling the probate continued to handle it and is still involved to this day. And so there was never an issue before the trial level about whether Mr. Prostrello failed to turn over any assets to the new personal representative, whether he failed to account to the new personal representative, and whether he failed to maintain any assets. That simply is not an issue in this case. Now, was there a formal accounting done and papers and things like that? The answer is no, but that has still not been a contested issue in this case. The timing of Mr. Prostrello's involvement in this case is very important. Mr. Prestrella was appointed to be the personal representative a little over a month after Mr. Brownlee had passed away. Brownlee passed away in August of 1997, and my client, Jerry Prestrella, was appointed in late September of 1997. It took until December of 2000 before the issue was raised about who owned the equipment and whether that was a valid gift. And that issue then was decided by the, or at least a memorandum decision was issued by the trial court in June of 2001. But an order did not come down from the trial court until December of 2001. And then, of course, that case went up on appeal and became Brownlee 1. Mr. Prestrella was permitted to be discharged as the personal representative on November 12 of 2002, 8 days before Brownlee 1 came down. And Mr. Wagner, in that same order discharging Mr. Prestrella, was then appointed as a personal representative. He signed his acceptance of the appointment on, I believe it was November 25 of 2002, and so a matter of days after Brownlee 1 came down. It is our position throughout this case that until Brownlee 1 was fully decided and that litigation ended, my client could not accurately determine, number one, the ownership of the equipment, and number two, the effect that had on taxes. And so that issue was finally resolved, but it was after my client was discharged in this case.
Weekly argues 9 months after death, before Brownlee 1's decided, that your client at that time, Mr. Prestrella, took the position that the taxes for the equipment were owed by the estate or by Mr. Brownlee because he was going to receive that as a gift. You took the position it was a gift, or your client did, filed the tax return based on that and didn't collect the tax, even though that was a Brownlee issue.
That is true.
And why is that not a valid argument on the part of Weekly?
The question here is whether my client did something that violated the standard of care. And first of all, he relied on the assistance of his attorney in that matter. And there's been no challenge in this case to Mr. Foley having served as the attorney at that time. And in fact, in the context of that time period, and Mr. Stoltenberg alluded to this, the estate had paid the taxes by funds from Ms. Weekly. This record does not show that she objected to that. She also gave $25,000 to the estate to use in paying its estate tax and inheritance tax bills. No objection to that. I do not dispute, however, your point that it was recognized by the estate that Randy Brownlee had an obligation to pay a share of taxes. That later became disputed because Randy Brownlee disputed it. To this day, disputes that. And, of course, Jeannie Weekly took a different position when she filed her petition in December of 2000 to challenge those taxes, which eventually resulted in Brownlee 1. She took the position that the trust should have been paying all of the taxes. And so that was always up in the air, always undecided and in litigation. Another point that was made in the prior argument was that talked about the damages and specifically directed the court's attention to the last page of Exhibit 8. Now, when it came to deciding damages in this case, if I understand the appellant's position, they determined that based on an amended judgment that was entered in 2006, so now this is some 4 years after my client was discharged and had no contact, that there was an amended judgment entered which set the damages that they're requesting in this case. If you turn to that amended judgment, which is Exhibit A, and you turn to the last page, which Mr. Stoltenberg correctly pointed out, sets forth the detail of how the numbers were calculated. It is very telling to note that the calculation of interest starts on June 21 of 2001, which was the date that the trial court first determined the tax apportionment issue and the gift issue, which of course went up on appeal. Note that the calculation, which is based on a stipulation reached by the parties in the litigation at that time, a stipulation we were not a party to, does not go back prior to that in time. And I think that's very important in showing that even at that time they did not claim they had any damage or any loss until that issue about gift and apportionment was first decided by the trial court, and of course it went up on appeal and became Brownlee number one. In the trial of this matter, we objected to the evidence about that amended judgment because we were not a party to that action. Attorney Foley had testified in this case that Jerry Prostrello was not even aware of that judgment. He may have been aware of the decision in Brownlee 1 shortly after that was rendered in 02, but was not a party to and was not aware of that amended judgment, and yet the plaintiffs are trying to have us bound by that very thing. The key in this case is whether, when all of the evidence taken as a whole, leaves this court with a conviction that a mistake was made. This is a dispute about facts. There isn't a lot of dispute about what the duty is. The question here is whether the facts show that my client breached that duty that he has in the law. And we do not deny that he had certain duties. The trial court, after considering all the evidence, found that my client did not breach that duty. And I don't think that there is any evidence any strong evidence in this case that would lead this court to conclude definitely and firmly that the trial court was wrong in that ruling. If you read the trial court's decision, it carefully considered all of the evidence in this matter, and it made distinctions between the two personal representatives. And that's very important, because I think until Brownlee 1 was decided, these issues were not set. After Brownlee 1 was decided, then perhaps action should have been taken, as commented by this court in Brownlee 2 when it asked, why has so much time gone by since Brownlee 1 was decided? Unless the court has other questions for me, that is all I have to present at this time, and we would respectfully request that this court affirm the trial court in finding that Jerry Prostrello did not breach his duty.
Thank you, Mr. Roby. Mr. Power, you have 10 minutes, sir.
May it please the court, counsel. Weekly has shown this court that the estate still owes her $168,000. What she's failed to show this court, or the circuit court, however, is what portion, if any, of that shortfall was caused by the alleged negligence of the successor personal representative, Bob Wagner. That failure is fatal to her case. That failure is fatal because personal representatives are not insurers of estates. They are only liable for losses actually caused by their own negligence. Unfortunately, shortfalls happen. They happen for lots of reasons. The personal representative is only liable if you can show that their negligence caused that shortfall. And you have to establish the portion of that with reasonable certainty. This she completely failed to do. The circuit court correctly rejected the argument that it was enough for her to simply show that she still owed money. She's pointed to two assets that she claims Wagner should have collected more for sooner than he did. But she's failed to show how much she should have collected. To boil it down into the simplest terms, what she needed to do was say, here's what Wagner collected for the equipment. Here's what he should have collected for it. The difference is my damages. She never provided the circuit court with any evidence that would have allowed it to make that calculation, much less to do it with reasonable certainty. The same is true for the estate taxes. She argues that Wagner should have collected for the federal estate taxes owed by Randy Brown. It's undisputed that he has instituted a lawsuit on behalf of the estate. That lawsuit is still pending. Weekly needed to come in and say, through a tax attorney expert, here's what Randy Brownlee's federal tax liability is. We may not know how this case will turn out, but we can at least give a reasonable estimate of what the estate's net recovery in that lawsuit will be. Maybe if she'd done that, she'd have an argument that in equity, the court ought to consider that. She didn't even attempt to do that.
Did she bring forth an expert witness on the standard of care?
No, Your Honor.
Do you need one?
Yes, we believe you do, because Wagner is entitled to rely on Foley. She's also argued that because Wagner is an attorney, that he should have used the skills he had as an attorney. And we believe the questions at issue in this case, which is how soon should Wagner have stopped negotiating with Randy Brownlee to try and achieve a settlement? When should he have filed suit? That's a classic judgment call. You need someone to come in and say, John Foley and Bob Wagner made an error in judgment.
Don't you have an obligation during that period of time that you're discussing to obtain something? Maybe he had to pay rent while he's using the equipment, while he's negotiating?
Absolutely, we believe he should have had to pay rent, and we sued him for that, and we lost. And that goes to the point you're making about inconsistent results. Litigation has uncertain results. We all thought Randy Brownlee should have paid for the time he owned that equipment, but unfortunately a jury determined otherwise. That's why, in hindsight, Wagner's decision to negotiate with Randy Brownlee to try to get all the money that was owed to Weekly through a settlement was right. Because as it turned out, he lost the lawsuit for the rent and use of the equipment. So all she's claiming is that he should have sold the equipment sooner and that he would have realized more money if he had sold it sooner. And she's presented...
Just to interrupt you a little bit, can you kind of go through what your client actually did?
Sure.
To preserve or to move this along?
Wagner becomes personal representative in late November 2002, approximately the same time this court issues Brownlee 1. So what Wagner and Foley do at that point is they go to Randy Brownlee and they say, based on Brownlee 1, we think you owe money for the taxes, we think you owe money for the time you've had this equipment, and we think you need to return the equipment or purchase it from the estate.
What time frame did that take up?
That starts in November 2002. Those negotiations go on for a year. Because twice, Brownlee actually agreed to pay amounts that we believe would be enough to pay Weekly everything she was owed. However, when it came time to sign, he would renege. He did that twice. And so, in the fall of 2003, Wagner and Foley conclude, all right, he's not going to pay off Weekly through negotiations. We've got to file suit. So then they file suit. And the sticking point in the negotiations was that Randy Brownlee never wanted to pay Weekly's attorney fees and interest. He indicated he was willing to pay what she was owed as a devise, but not the attorney fees or interest she believed she was entitled. So at that point, Weekly, Randy Brownlee, and the estate say, all right, let's litigate the issue of the attorney fees and interest first, get a ruling on that, and then we can settle the rest of it.
So are you saying that if they had accepted the offer, Ms. Weekly had accepted this offer and only paid her own attorney's fees, that she'd had nothing further to complain about, that she'd have been paid off in full by the estate?
No, not at all. The estate was always trying to collect everything Weekly said she was owed. The problem in the negotiations was that Randy Brownlee didn't want to pay that amount. And once the estate realized Brownlee wasn't going to compromise on that, Weekly wasn't going to compromise on her demand she was owed that, we said, all right, got to file suit against Brownlee and try and get it through litigation.
Maybe you didn't understand my question. My question is, if that deal had gone through, if Brownlee had paid the money, would
yes.
that have paid off Weekly in full, other than the
yes.
attorney's fees? And we wouldn't be here today.
Yes. Absolutely. Absolutely. That was always the goal, to get a settlement payment for Randy Brownlee that would fully satisfy Weekly. And twice he agreed to that and then backed out. And so then they tried to litigate this issue of attorney fees and interest, thinking that, well, if there was a ruling that told Brownlee, look, you've got to pay interest and attorney fees, he would do it. And then they could settle for an amount that would pay the rest of it. And unfortunately, that idea didn't work out either. The court made a ruling on interest and attorney fees. Weekly appealed it. There was no settlement. So then, finally, in 2006, our client, the estate, repossesses the equipment, sells it for $37,500. And there's absolutely no evidence that if he'd sold it earlier in his tenure, he would have realized more money for it. They provided no evidence from an appraiser of equipment or from Randy Brownlee about the equipment's condition from 2002 to the time it was sold in 2006. They've made no attempt to do that. So the circuit court simply had no basis to say, all right, Wagner, I think you should have done it earlier. Here's what you would have realized if you'd done it earlier. Had no way to do that.
But part of that is your client's fault. I mean, your client, when your client becomes the representative, he could have gone out and taken pictures of this equipment, got appraisals for it. That was his duty, wasn't it, as the representative, rather than simply negotiating over a period of years and not trying to lock down what that property is worth to the estate?
Well, Your Honor, the point I would make is Weekly has never argued she was unable to prove the value of the equipment. And the fact that my client, you may view the delays and things he didn't do as negligence, doesn't switch the burden of proof on the element of damages. Plaintiff bears the burden of proof on all essential elements. It was Weekly's burden to prove damages, and she has not shown that anything Wagner did or didn't do prevents her from being able to prove the value of the equipment. She could have subpoenaed records concerning the equipment from Randy Brownlee. She could have subpoenaed Brownlee to testify about the equipment's condition. She could have brought in an appraiser, perhaps even the appraiser who actually sold the equipment in 2006, and he could have testified to the court as to its value and provided a table of the value of equipment from 98 to 2006. She didn't even try to do that.
So are you conceding the answer to Justice Klonekamp's question but arguing that she never proved up her damages?
Essentially, yes. We believe Wagner had valid reasons for why he did things when he did them. But even if the court disagrees with that, she failed to prove damages. That's our position.
And then the follow-up to that is, all these things you're saying Weekly could have done, those are actually the duties of the personal representative, aren't they?
They may be duties of the personal representative in the administration.
They are. I'm not maybe, but they are, aren't they?
Yes, Your Honor. The personal representative has a duty to preserve the assets of the estate. In this lawsuit, however, it is the plaintiff's duty to prove the amount of damages.
Your time has expired, Mr. Power. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Stoltenberg, you have 10 minutes, sir.
A couple of things. First, Chief Justice, regarding your question concerning our objection, that is Plaintiff's Exhibit 9. We outlined that specifically. Regarding Jerry Prosperello's position regarding the payment of taxes, this court should be directed to a brief filed by the personal representative in January 2001. This is their position concerning who pays the taxes. Jerry Prosperello's. In order for the distribution of the assets and apportionment of taxes to be fair in this matter, the court should find that the beneficiaries of the will should be responsible for the taxes on property received by them through the will, and beneficiaries of the trust should be responsible for the taxes on property received by them through the trust. Why that's important is just this. That was Jerry Prosperello's position, but he didn't do it. He failed to collect any taxes from Randy Brownlee. And we get into, and Mr. Roby talks about the litigation that this was in. This litigation didn't start till December of 2000, over 3 years after his appointment as personal representative. What did he do for the first 3-plus years that he was personal representative to collect the taxes fairly, like he said he was going to, the position he takes? Nothing. Absolutely nothing. Then Mr. Roby talks about the litigation, that this equipment was in litigation, and therefore we couldn't figure out the taxes because of that. Well, I submit to you, Randy Brownlee received $60,000 worth of property that was subject to taxation that has never been in litigation. Never. Have they collected 1 cent of federal estate taxes on that? No, nothing. And this case can't be looked at in a vacuum. Brownlee 1 said, Everyone pays their fair share of taxes. It's apportioned under the UPC. Jerry Prestrella was saying the same thing. But actions speak louder than words. What did he do? Nothing. What did Bob Wagner do after Brownlee 1 was decided in 2002? He commences a lawsuit to collect those taxes in 2006. What did he do in the meantime? Negotiations, I guess. It's really, what did they do? And, you know, it's that old adage, it's hard to prove a negative, but omissions, malfeasance, not doing something is negligence. Negligence is the standard on breach of duty. In Brownlee 2, this court asked, what legal justification has the personal representative shown for the delays? No legal justification was given then. They got a second bite at the apple to give legal justification. Again, nothing else presented. Jeannie Weakley's damages, you know, that just goes in such a circle, but her damages are what she's owed. And a majority of her damages are the direct result of rulings of this court and of the lower courts saying she's been damaged due to delay. That's what interest is, damage due to delay.
What about Mr. Powers' comment that your client would have been paid off in full, but the deal fell apart because she insisted on attorney's fees on top of it?
She insisted on attorney fees and interest due to the delay. She won on those, Judge. She was entitled to that, legally entitled to interest. They could have, and again, you go back to, why is she entitled to interest? Why is she entitled to attorney fees for benefiting the estate? Because the PRs breached their duties. Sure, they would have loved to have settled with her and said, we'll pay you $82,535 in 2006. That's 9 years after the probate started. She was entitled to that, a dollar back then versus a dollar now. It's the present value of money, future value of money. We were asserting back then, you're negligent. You owe us. And what always gets lost in this case is it's not Jeannie Weakley versus Randy Brownlee. It's the estate not doing their job and pitting these heirs against each other. Jeannie Weakley, the PR wasn't doing their job, so she files a petition. Hey, there's $170,000 of equipment out there that should be part of the probate estate. PR, you're not doing your job. Jeannie Weakley has to step in. Hey, federal estate taxes is not being collected. Maybe this trust owes it. There was conflicting clauses in the trust and the will. The PR has the duty to do those things, to determine that. The PR was not doing their job. So Jeannie Weakley steps in, and now the argument is, well, she caused the litigation. She caused the delays. If they had done their job, she wouldn't have had to step in and do it for them. And that is the reason she's been damaged, is because they haven't done their job. And, Chief, I'm done, subject to your questions.
No one has ever chastised for quitting early.
I know you'd say that.
I have a question.
Yes.
If we do not accept your argument that her damages are what she is owed, you know, out of the estate, then you tell us how you prove the damages. The trial court held you didn't prove the theory of damages. You claimed it wasn't your burden to prove them, right?
We feel as though we proved our damages first with the how much she's owed. But second, you can get to it's $171,000 of equipment in 1998 it's appraised for. In 2006, 9 years later, it's sold, netting out $26,000.
Okay, but that amount Is the 171 binding on Mr. Wagner as a personal representative? Because he didn't take over until about 4 or 5 years later.
If that goes to how these two personal representatives are intertwined. And I'll give the circuit court, Judge Erickson, I know, had to struggle with the fact of how to apportion damages between the two, because that's difficult. Because who had possession of that equipment during that entire time was Randy Brownlee. Who owned that equipment during that time was the estate.
Do the damages have to be apportioned, or are they joint and several liability?
We're asking that they're joint and several. And I believe they are, because they're so intertwined. Had Jerry Prestrello filed a formal accounting, had he filed an inventory as required by statute, we wouldn't have this issue. Had Bob Wagner demanded that he file a supplemental inventory, that he file an accounting, those are statutory mandated duties that former and successor personal representative have with each other. They didn't do them, and now they step back and say, well, you didn't prove it because we didn't do our job.
Does a personal representative have an obligation to prove that at the time he took over, the equipment was only worth, say, $100,000?
He has an obligation to do an inventory.
Does he have the burden of going forward to show that, assuming you've made a prima facie case of some element of damages?
Yes, he has an obligation under the statutes to do an inventory and accounting of the assets that come into his control. Didn't do it. And that's what created the problems for Judge Erickson at the lower court level. And, you know, it's Jeannie Weakley's burden to show that they breached their duties. She clearly did that. It's Jeannie Weakley's burden to show the damages. The proximate cause between them is, the testimony is from John Foley, is that there is, if the PRs had collected construction assets, had they collected the taxes, there would have been sufficient funds to pay Jeannie Weakley.
One last question. Is it the trial court's responsibility to extrapolate the damages between the amount of time that Prestrello was the personal representative as opposed to the amount of time that Wagner was the PR?
No.
Why?
Because he can hold them jointly and severally liable, and it is their responsibility to show to Judge Erickson, lower court, what amount of damages of this $168,000 plus accruing interest does not relate to them. And Mr. Roby was attempting to do that during his argument, saying from June 2001, and he was using some dates. That's what they did not do at the lower court. And that cannot be Jeannie Weakley's burden and responsibility to prove their cross claims against each other.
Your time has expired, counsel. Thank you. We'll be in recess for 10 minutes.